effective oratory. Friends, teachers, school board members, lend me your ears. Truth is under attack. We must declare war on error. Lies, hypocrisy, deception wash over us in muddy waves. We must combat this tide of deception. We must persuasively promote truth. We may prefer to hide behind the idea that actions speak louder than words. While this saying is true, it does not release a speaker from the obligation to prepare to speak the truth with power, persuasion, and authority. Effective oratory is a masterpiece of art collecting dust in the school storage room. Yet its importance to God's people is increasing. Around the globe, lies are attacking truth. And actions alone will not combat this deception. We must prepare to stand up for truth in thoughts, words, and actions. Actions may speak louder than words. But I have found that when I speak words of truth, those words challenge me to act upon the words that I have said. My father had a friend named Jack. While he was in the military, they had not yet been taught about non-resistance. But they were doing their very best to live the Christian life. And Jack was in the Navy. And as such, he was transferred often from one ship to the next. Jack made a point that whenever he was transferred to a new ship, he would go up to his fellow sailors and say, "Lyndon, I want you to know I'm a Christian." Why would he do something like that? Because it made him accountable to live up to being a Christian. Therefore, words of truth beget actions of truth. And deeds of truth lend weight to words of truth. Truth is a two-edged sword, dividing asunder both deception and corruption. It is true that actions speak loudly, but words of truth speak just as loudly, just because they're true. The Word of God is living truth, powerful truth, persuasive truth. When we speak, we are to state the truth that God has revealed to us. The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. We are to let this truth, this Word of Christ, dwell in us richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another, considering one another to provoke and to love and good works, exhorting, reproving, and rebuking one another. We are to speak the things which become sound doctrine. Our speech is to be sound speech that cannot be condemned. Our speech is to minister grace to the hearers. That by speaking the truth in love, we may grow up into Him in all things, which is the head, even Christ. Pointless, disorganized, uninspiring speeches don't belong among God's people. God granted us the availability of truth, the capability to talk, and the responsibility to speak the truth with strength and skill. Many of the greatest examples of effective oratory were spoken during times of war. One of the main features of excellent oratory is a clear argument. There are few events in our lives that lead to stronger arguments than wars. Take Hitler, for example. The powers of oratory persuasion that he had were absolutely phenomenal. His argument that the people of Germany were being unfairly punished for the devastation of World War I held bushels of truth, but it was rooted in lies. His massive rallies and emotionally charged speeches plunged the developed world into a destructive Second World War, effected by oratory. I believe oratory is the most undervalued subject in our schools. If our students studied speaking as much as reading and writing, the good news of the gospel would ring with resounding echoes from the Cascades, across the Rockies, and over the Himalayas. If our students could speak face to face as well as they can phone and text, our friendships would be local, meaningful, and realistic. If our students learned to stand up for truth as well as they could for their own opinions, we would have far fewer disgruntled church members and a lot more missionaries. And at brothers' meetings, our churches could harmoniously approve current applications of truth. If our students studied oratory in the Bible, in history, and in the current era, tomorrow's ministers would have the tools to light the flames of truth in others. And when, and this may not be long, our brethren are dragged before judge and jury, they could clearly, concisely, and convincingly state their position on truth. This workshop is not intended to give you ammunition to criticize speakers. The purpose of this workshop is to inspire us to practice and teach effective oratory. The first concept we will focus on is a worthy topic. We are at war with seeds of deception carried on winds of false teaching. Thus, we must search to find a seed of truth that is worth talking about. While Hitler was an effective orator, his strategy in war was flawed. Germany was punishing the British and Americans in Western Europe until Hitler decided to open a second front toward Russia in Eastern Europe. He broke a cardinal rule of war. An army can only successfully attack one thing at a time. Soldiers call this reaching an objective. Had Hitler focused on one objective at a time, this meeting would likely be spoken in German, and I, as a minority person, would probably be in a concentration camp. Like Hitler, we struggle with choosing an objective and then sticking to it. Yet this is the most important part of preparing to speak. We must be convinced of the importance of a single meaningful theme, and we must convince our students that content is king. What we say matters more than how we say it. Many boring speakers actually present strong content in a bland way. Conversely, many charismatic speakers entertain without saying a thing. It doesn't need to be either way. We can persuasively promote truth. A worthy topic. Audiences expect valuable material. When Nicodemus got up in the middle of the night and came to talk to Jesus, he did not want to know what the price of tea was in China. Letter A. Be specific. I was forced into this by my cousin Carl, who in any discussion would wait until I had run out of wind and say, "What's your point?" Focus on one truth, one perspective. Be correct. While your students are studying for a subject, make sure that they do their research. Brother Steve this morning talked about the security man at Shasta Dam. One of my students presented a report on Shasta Dam, and he mentioned the man that Steve talked about. I can't remember his name now. Mm-hmm. Fact check. When my students are doing research and they come and say that Shasta Dam is the tallest dam in the world, wait a minute. Let's check on that. Make sure that that's right. Content is king. Be clear, plain, understandable to your audience. When Jesus was talking to Nicodemus, he said, "Ye must be born again." And immediately Nicodemus tootily took off down the wrong street. Jesus said, "Ye must be born of the Spirit." Now we're talking. Now Nicodemus understood. Be concise. Boil it down. Stay on time. If you can state your thesis, your one topic, in one sentence, you've got it. Find that nugget. Persuasively promote truth. Be relevant. Tell them what they need to hear, not what they want to hear. When your students are choosing a subject to talk about, make it something that is worth talking about. Students would love to tell you to write a subject, for example, about their favorite vehicle. That is not a worthy topic. That is not relevant. My friend Eric is a great blessing in my life. And a couple years ago, we were sitting down talking, and Eric said, "Jenna, I used to really look up to you." "But then I realized just how much pride there was in your heart. I needed to hear that." Our bishop, when I was growing up, Brother John Troyer, dear brother who's still living, he's in his 90s now, after my third failed attempt to find a life companion, he came over to me and laid his hand on my shoulder and said, "Jonah, I think you should learn how to do laundry and wash dishes." One evening, I made a phone call to a neighboring church, and it turned out to be a wrong number. And I said, "I'm sorry, sir. I'll let you go." He said, "No. Are you married?" I said, "Yeah. Married, why?" I said, "Listen, my wife and I had a fight. I'm on the way to town. Flowers or jewelry?" I said, "Sir, do you really want this to go away?" "Yeah, I do. I do. What's the trick?" I said, "You have to go home and talk to her." "No! It'll take 2 hours! Can I buy diamonds?" Not easy to say what people need to hear. Prophet Nathan came to David, a king. He's standing there, tells him a story. And David gets mad. "And do you want to know about something scary? It's a mad king." I can't quite imagine how that looked. I think David was a scary looking man when he was angry. And he asks Nathan, "Who is that man?" And Nathan says, "Thou
art the man. Lay his finger right on it.
Be relevant. Be logical. Truth and logic are like soldiers and weapons. They're powerful only together. A soldier without a sword doesn't do much good. A sword without a soldier is equally useless. Jesus, when the Pharisees came to him and said, "You're casting out demons by the prince of demons." Jesus said, "Now wait a minute, let's stop and think about this. A kingdom divided against itself. Logic. It's truth, analogic. Teach your students critical thinking." I believe Brother Jonathan mentioned that. Or analytical thinking. Teach them how to do that. When David, after he had numbered the children of Israel, went to the threshing floor of Araunah, Araunah offered to give it to him. And David said, "I will not offer that which cost me nothing." Truth and logic are stuck together. We can't take them apart. When I was at the age of accountability, the evening the Lord was really speaking to my heart, the evangelist got up and talked about choices. And when it was all said and done, he was giving us the choice, heaven or hell. Take your pick. It was very logical. Jesus with Nicodemus. John 3:16 was probably the favorite, most common verse quoted in the Bible. Is it logical? "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth on him..." See the logic? The Bible's full of it. And we are supposed to use it in speaking. Artistic organization is the second thing. Famous Secretary of State here in the United States, lived years ago, named Henry Kissinger, hired a new speechwriter. And the speechwriter was very excited about being a speechwriter for this famous man. And so he wrote a speech. He was supposed to have it at Henry's hotel room at 8 o'clock in the morning. So at 8 o'clock he shows up and knocks on the door. Henry opens the door and hands him the speech. And Henry says, "Come back in 2 hours. Speechwriter goes back to his room. He's there twiddling his thumbs, and hoping that this is going to be okay. 2 hours later, he comes back. Knocks on the door. Henry opens it, hands him back the speech, and says, "Is that the best you can do?" So the speechwriter goes back downstairs. And he pours over this thing and realizes that he actually was digressing from the main point quite often. And it was weakening his argument. So he narrows this thing down. And till he's got a very good speech, and he takes it back up there and knocks on Henry's door. Henry opens it. "Come back in 2 hours." So he goes back down to his room, twiddles his thumbs for a while. Goes back up. Opens the door. There's Henry. "Is that the best you can do?" So he takes it back down. By this time, it's late in the evening, and he pours over that speech all night long. Till the next morning, he's finally added all the illustrations that he possibly could that made this one truth extremely powerful. And at 8 o'clock the next morning, he carries it down to, or up to, Henry Kissinger's room, knocks on the door, opens it up, and Henry right away says, "Is this the best you can do?" And the speechwriter said, "I was up all night." Henry said, "Okay, I'll read it now." That's what God wants from us. First thing in this is your audience. Who are you trying to convince? Your students should be taught to think about this. What is your connection to the people you are talking to? It is easy for me to use examples from the Bible because I believe you are Bible readers. If you were not, I could not be doing this. Start with what is familiar to your students. One of the seven laws of teaching. Listen to what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9, verses 19 and following. But for though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all, that I may gain the more. Unto the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jews. To them that are under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law. To them that are without the law is without the law, but being not without the law to God, but under the law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without the law. To the weak became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. I am made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. And here is the nitty-gritty. And this I do for the gospel's sake. I think it would not be sacrilegious to say for the truth's sake. When thinking about your audience, think about their proficiency. That's the first thing there. Their age level, their education, background. Engage them. If you can, get them to answer a simple question or two. Respect them. You remember the conversation Nabal had with David? When he said, I knew of many servants who have left their masters. He was referring to David leaving Saul. He knew that. Versus Abigail, Nabal's wife, when she came to David, she said, may your enemies be slung as from a sling. Did she know David's story too? I think so. Paul, when he was on Mars Hill, he said, whom therefore you ignorantly worship, that's who I'm going to tell you about. The location. While preparing for this topic, I needed to consider the fact that this is at a teacher's meeting. The surrounding landscape. Why do you think I chose the Cascades? Local terms. For example, how many people in this room are ducks? You can't admit it. If you're from Oregon, you should know what that means. Abraham Lincoln at Gettysburg. And I hope to read you that speech shortly. He knew where he was. Martin Luther King Jr., when he was at the Capitol Mall of Washington, D.C., he was aware of the event, of the effort people had put into getting there. Jesus, when he was at the temple, this glorious building with his disciples, and he says, not one stone. Can't you just picture them looking at those stones? The time period. Season. Is it appropriate to speak about flowers in December? Might not really be. The time of the day. In the afternoon when it's warm, you have to be a little bit more exciting than you do early in the morning. Okay? And once again, be punctual. Think about Paul when he was on the ship with the others. He said, the Lord stood by me last night. What a comforting thought to a bunch of people on a ship that was messed up in a storm. Franklin D. Roosevelt, after Pearl Harbor, a day that shall live in infamy. Nathan Hale, standing on a ladder with a rope around his neck. His last words, I regret that I have but one life to give for my country. And he steps off the ladder and snaps his neck. Letter B, structure. You know, in military, structure is a very big thing. Military has a command structure where you have your privates and sergeants and so on. Does God care about structure? How we speak? Does the Bible have structure? Let's think about Gideon's attack on the Midianites. How many groups of people were there in that attack?
Three.
That's right. Does three have anything to do with God? Think about our military. It is basically composed of land, sea, and air forces. What are the three parts of any composition? The introduction, the body, and then the conclusion. Your main points should also be given in threes. Give your lists in threes. Think about Jesus' story of the Good Samaritan. How many people aside from the Good Samaritan are in that story? Three. That makes the story that much more powerful. Use three adjectives in front of a noun. And so on. It is powerful to speak in threes. If you want a beautiful example of threes, look at 1 Corinthians 13. The order of importance. A speech should start low and build up to a climax. Think about the story of Jesus. We start with this little baby in a manger, and we end with a victorious king rising into the heavens, who's going to come back again. Amen. Think about Abraham when he was talking to God. He starts with, if there were 40, if there were 30, if there were 10, so on. Think about Joshua with the children of Israel. He said, you need to serve God, so on. But then he ends with, I don't care what you all do. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Patrick Henry, the man who said, give me liberty or give me death. That was the end of a speech in which he was trying to convince the senators of Virginia to join the Revolutionary War. Winston Churchill, speaking the speech, we shall fight. He ends with the reason. We're going to fight for freedom. That's what we're standing up for. Build up. Peter at Pentecost, he starts with this build up. Jesus was the Son of God and so on. Till finally he gets to, you all killed him. And they say, what are we supposed to do? Repent and be baptized. Now we get to the point. A theme. A speech should have an overarching story or illustration. Today we're trying to use war or fight. It should be something that is connected to your topic, not just an arbitrary picture or something. And it should end with the objective that you're aiming for. Think about John 14 with me for a little bit. Is there an overarching theme in that chapter? It starts with, in my Father's house are many mansions. And towards the end, Jesus says, peace I leave with you, my peace I give unto you. So on. He's desiring to bring people to peace. Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech, I Have a Dream, he was visualizing a change. This was not... Most of us only hear a very short part of that speech. Truth should motivate people. A purpose. When Winston Churchill gave the speech known as Our Finest Hour, he was telling the people of Britain that just because World War II was going to be a hard time did not mean that it would be a wasted time. Someone mentioned using a conflict as an opportunity, and that was that one. And by the way, did Winston Churchill say he had only to offer blood, sweat, and tears? No, he did not. He said, I come to offer toil. Blood, toil, tears, and sweat. He said four things, and people automatically turned it into three. Wonder why that happened. Sometimes truth is self-evident. God spoke when he was speaking to Job. He begins with, who is this that darkens counsel with words without knowledge? See, his techniques, liars use tricks. Can honest people use tricks as well? Keep your audience focused. Think about Jesus. One of the tricks is stories. Tell stories. Use stories. An anecdote is a short story to make a point or stir an emotion. How did the prophet Nathan convince David that there was a problem? He told a story. Parables. Those are stories that are actually crafted to teach a lesson. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus didn't just say, "Wise people, obey me, and foolish ones, don't." How does he teach that lesson? He says, every person who hears these sayings and does them is like the wise man who builds his house upon the rock. Turns it into a story that sticks. A witticism is a joke or some irony, paradox. Think about Jesus' mote and the beam. It's almost funny to imagine someone with a telephone pole stuck in one eye trying to get a sliver out of someone else's eye. And our minds latch onto those things. Illustrations, word pictures. The Indian Tecumseh did this. He said that if we do not unite together, the Americans will sweep us away as the sun melts the snow in spring. Jesus, how many illustrations did he use in the Sermon on the Mount? He used similes. You are the light of the world, city set on a hill, so on. He used metaphors. Something is something. Ye are the salt of the earth. Personification. Behold the lilies of the field. They don't sow or reap like people do, and so on. When these Pharisees came to Jesus asking him about taxes, he said, "Show me a coin." Repetition. You might have heard the saying, tell them what you're going to tell them, then tell them and tell them what you told them. I don't quite believe that unless you're going to reword things. We should not just repeat what we're going to say over and over. We can use parallelism, though. For example, John F. Kennedy, when he said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what can you do for your country?" Jesus in the Beatitudes, cause and effect. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. So on. In 1 Corinthians 13, Paul uses building repetition when he says, "Now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known." Then said I, "O Lord God, behold, I cannot speak, for I am a child." But the Lord said unto me, "Say not, I am a child, for thou shalt go to all that I shall send thee, and whatsoever I command thee, thou shalt speak." Those words of Jeremiah. The third point is rehearsed presentation. What do soldiers do when they are not fighting? They practice fighting. General Patton believed that soldiers who are drilled until they are nearly worn out and disciplined severely will be the most successful. And he was right. Our Bible says that we are studied to show ourselves approved unto the best educated people in our land. No? Study to show yourselves approved unto God. If you tell your students that when they are studying, that's a much bigger thing than them trying to please you. Prepare physically. Demosthenes of Athens did this. He was a scrawny runt of a young man who wanted to become one of the speakers. He had something on his heart. So he would run up and down the slopes, going down to the shore along the Greek coastline there. He would put marbles in his mouth and practice speaking with, pebbles from the shoreline in his mouth and practice speaking with them. And then he would shout across the waves to build up his voice until he could outshout the waves. He became a very famous orator because he prepared physically. Your students need exercise. They need exercise in learning how to use gestures. Many students stand up and have no idea what to do with their hands, and so their hands tend to do distracting things while they are talking. Enunciation. Truth should be understood. To speak clearly, you must open your mouth. Think about a picture. Would you rather see one on a little tiny cell phone or a great big poster? the size of the hole opening in our mouth regulates that. Our volume. Truth should be heard in the corners of every room in every country. Or if your students are not sure that they can crank up the volume, ask them to practice their speech on the playground. Prepare verbally. Don't let your audience be your guinea pigs. Soldiers' worst days should be while they are training. Tell your students to read their script orally in front of a mirror or some other thing. Add some notes about how they're going to accomplish things along the way. And then prepare mentally. Deal with any distractions from your truth, including your own fears. And believe it or not, I have a deathly fear of public speaking. Practice basic motor skills, such as walking to the front of a room and turning around. Brother Aaron, would you please just stand up, walk up here beside me, turn around, face the crowd. You may sit back down. Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you.
He did an excellent job because he did not only stand up and turn around, he also made eye contact. I have my students practice doing that. Stand up, turn around, look at everyone in the eyes, and smile. Right? And tell them to have those first words ready to come out. Be ready to talk right away. Know who you are. Don't try to imitate another speaker. Instruct your students not to try to imitate people they look up to. Know your weaknesses. If you can't tell jokes, don't. Okay? Vulnerability can create empathy. It's okay to let people know that you're shook up about what you're doing. You should also know your strengths. If you always tell jokes, do not volunteer to give a eulogy. And ask some honest people what their impressions of you are. I did this, asking some folks what their first impression of me was. It was helpful. I asked them what kind of animal I would be if I was an animal. They said a monkey, a bear, or I think it might have been a slobbering Labrador retriever. Now, I'm going to share a few of the most famous speeches ever given. And permit me, please, to channel the speakers to the best of my ability. And I want you to see which of the things that I talk to you about are used in each of these speeches. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will be judged not by the color of their skin, but on the content of their character. Is that a good speech? What did you notice about it? Was it true? Was it artistically organized? And the speaker was probably a much better speaker than I am. It was presented in a powerful way. 87 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of it as a final resting place for those who died here, that the nation might live. This we may in all propriety do, but in a larger sense we cannot dedicate. We cannot consecrate. We cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have hallowed it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note, nor long remember what we say here, while it can never forget what they did here. It is rather for us, the living, we here be dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we may take increased devotion to the cause for which they here gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve these dead should not have died in vain. That the nation shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Good speech.
Latin dishwashing. If I may insert something, that was how that speech was seen in that day. Today it is seen as a masterpiece. And I think if our students don't like us, we can maybe rest in the fact that having done our best, God
has done. Yes. Thank you for that. That speech was decried as being too short to fit the occasion. It came after a 2-hour oratory by someone else who was famous at the time for speaking. Mm-hmm. However, did Abraham Lincoln use repetition effectively? Mm-hmm. Which word gets repeated?
Death.
Death? Which other word? I'll give you a huge hint. It is in this phrase. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate. The word dedicate is found 8 times in that speech. But it's so artfully placed in there that you hardly think about the fact that it's being repeated. We're going to break into another speaker. Even though large tracts of Europe and many old and famous states have fallen or may fall into the grasp of the Gestapo and all the odious apparatus of Nazi rule, we shall not flag or fail. We shall go to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence in the air. We shall fight to defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields, in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And even if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the sea, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until in God's good time the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and liberation of the old. Good speech. Powerful speech. One more. Tell me what was powerful about that speech.
Repetition,
we shall fight. What about the illustrations, the picture words? I should have mentioned that in some of the other speeches as well. Did the pictures in your mind add to rather than detract from? I think they do. All right. Think about those again in this speech given on Mars Hill in Athens by an extremely famous and excellent speaker named Paul. I don't have time to read it all, so we'll get only part of it. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth in temples, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything. Seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things, and hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bonds of their habitation, that they should seek the Lord, if haply they might feel after him, and find him, though he be not far from every one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as certain also of your poets have said. Good speech? Okay, which things did he use there? I would like to hear it from you.
Sets of three.
Anything else?
Locally relevant.
Locally relevant. He was using words, he was repeating words from a poem written by an Athenian. Our words can effect inspiration when we speak them with power. Our speech can effect conviction when we speak with persuasion. Our orations will effect life change when we speak the truth. In this war on error, the forces of darkness seem to be overwhelming the soldiers of truth. But regardless of how many minions the devil employs to further his deceptive lies in the last days, truth is still truth. Truth is still powerful. And truth is going to endure beyond the end of this world. Are we convinced that it is up to the people of God to stand for truth? Are we committed to promoting the truth in its power? Are we willing to engage our time, our talents, and even our own lives to battle for truth? No middle road exists. We are either advancing error or promoting truth. And when it is all said and done, regardless which side we choose in this conflict, truth will stand. Will we be standing with it?